Later, we listened for more than an hour to his story, and heard him explain his approximately 300 photographs, including some he said he himself had shot in space. It was breathtaking. Yet, within me, I missed the feeling of joy and sympathy which I really should have felt. Some funny instinct was giving me a kind of negative pulse, signals which concern me as person rather than the things he said and showed us. Observing the man more closely, I saw that his features were worn out and hard, and that he had cold and tired eyes. His forehead was deeply lined, and he looked older than his 40 years. But his voice was good and strong and healthy, and so were his movements. He was very adept in using his right arm. His smile was sometimes disconcertingly friendly and pure, but the feeling of discomfort never left me. It is still with me. This expose is written for a very few friends who know me well, and also know me as story, so I do not need to go into details. With frankness, he told us about his girlfriend Samjays from the Pleiades. At first, I felt much sympathy with her for having contacted a poor handicapped man like Amir. She seemed to be giving him some extremely interesting information on space and astronomy and to take him for a ride occasionally. A few months after my visit, Ilse von Jacobi sent me part of his writings, 15 conversations with Samjays. They proved to be rather disappointing to me and I did not like at all her manner of speech. It sounded often rather faulty and unfriendly, rather frightening. In 1976, Mir started to attack in his magazine Wassermannsicht every religion in the world, all churches and sects, refuting the need for worship or belief in God. It sounded rather familiar, poison for the people, and so on. The articles were written in an offhand but spiteful, even vicious way, and they sounded so superficial I doubt that either Samjays or Mir knew the difference between religions and such in the established church institutions. I liked him less and less, and I stopped writing to him. But I continued to bring interested friends to his place. He always liked meeting new people and was always polite, even friendly, with them. I never talked to him about my objections, mostly because we were never alone. His story and his films never failed to impress me. There was, in my eyes, no reason to doubt his veracity. And soon I found out that the man suffered from a deep inferiority complex, that he was haunted by bad childhood memories, by his experiences at school, in a children's home, in the Foreign Legion, in jail, in hospitals. I was ready to take this into account and stayed friendly. Due to his lack of diplomacy, prudence, and understanding, he lost some very good friends. As he said, they were replaced immediately by newcomers. But there were some among his former friends who betrayed him and did a lot of damage to his image without his being aware of it. A lot of them even faked some UFO photos, doing pictures on a windowpane, showing them around and telling everybody how easy this was. I've got two of those fakes. I fell for them for only a few seconds, but people without training might readily fall for the trick. I, for one, am sure that Mir's pictures are no fakes. There's too much variety in them. If indeed he would be able to produce such perfect film materials, he would be under contract with the best paying movie companies for science fiction films, and he would be paid in the 100,000s for each movie to be sure. As an invalid, Mir draws a state pension of about 700 francs a month. Nobody in this country can live on such an amount with a wife and 3 children. Reluctantly, he's now asking for money for his interviews and demonstrations, which he did not do earlier. I know that he does not make money with his photographs, since I bought them for either 1.50 or 2.00 francs apiece, which barely covers his costs. He can't do the copies himself. To fake such extraordinary films, anybody would need a lot of money, but obviously, Edouard Mir is a very poor man. It was clear to me from the beginning that in due time, Edouard Mir's pictures would come under heavy attack, because it has been the fashion for the last 2 years to declare all close-up shots, showing clear details, as fakes, by those UFO researchers who pretend to know most and to do their research in a purely scientific manner. Some of those sophisticated UFO researchers, always ready to call other people hoaxers, fakers and liars, might be helpful in a conspiracy of defamation. Intending to unmask scoundrels, they are keeping back curiosity and interest and good photographic evidence from important people at universities and in government circles. Signed, Luzinstag, Baal. In October 1977, a man wearing a sweater and a light windbreaker walked the leaf-strewn gravel path from the Friof in Schmidruti to the Mir farm a quarter mile away. A handsome man, short in stature, with deep blue eyes and silver hair, when Del C. Stevens had retired a lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force. He now traveled the world investigating unusual UFO sightings and claims of contact. When Del Stevens had retired from the Air Force in 1963, after 23 years on active duty, over 4,000 hours of flying time, and top secret clearance. Graduated from the Army Air Corps First Test Pilot Training School, Stevens at age 20 had been the project officer for the development of the P-47 fighter plane, and during World War II had commanded an aircraft maintenance squadron, seeing only limited combat in the Pacific. After the war, the Air Force assigned Stevens to the Air Technical Intelligence Center at Wright Field, where he screened thousands of documents and advanced aeronautical blueprints captured by the Americans when the Germans fled their factories and air design centers. Many of the documents had been seized from the Nazi drawing board, details of exotic flying machines and rockets. Subsequently, Stevens was reassigned to Alaska, briefing and debriefing air crews of the Ptarmigan Project, a weather reconnaissance program in which B-29 crews mapped and photographed the polar surface. Because of encounters with strange circular aircraft reported by these returning crews, UFOs had piqued Stevens' interest even before the term flying saucer was coined in June 1947. Stevens' first involvement with a UFO came during a debriefing in which one of his crews claimed it had spotted a bogey flying at an altitude much higher than they were capable. Before long, Stevens' B-29 crews inside the Arctic Circle had reported dozens more such sightings involving speeds and aeronautical maneuvers unknown to our technology. Later, Stevens himself clocked one of these bogeys on radar. It was traveling 7,000 miles an hour. Based on my previous experience in the Air Intelligence Center, Stevens said, I was convinced that there was no Earth technology capable of producing air vehicles that could fly at thousands of miles per hour and make sharp angled turns at such high speeds, stop and even reverse instantly, stand still in the air, descend and ascend vertically at low and high speeds, land on the ice and water, and submerge underwater and emerge again and fly away. The B-29s on the Ptarmigan project came outfitted with still cameras and movie cameras, and many times the crews who reported witnessing such maneuverability also captured the exotic craft in photographs and on film. Stevens himself saw none of the physical evidence, because as soon as the exposed film arrived in its canister with the crew back at his base, Stevens sent it with the crew chief directly to Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, where, according to Stevens, the officer was met by Pentagon intelligence and taken someplace. Hearing nothing further about any of the sightings, Stevens began collecting articles and books on the UFO phenomenon. In a short while, he had acquired some of the first UFO photographs ever published, and he began to exchange copies of these photos for new ones taken by amateurs, as sightings became more prevalent. By 1976, Stevens' library on UFOs included 700 books and nearly 3,000 photographs, probably the largest private collection in the world, and one that was utilized extensively by documentary filmmakers. For nearly 30 years, he had corresponded and exchanged evidence regularly with most of the world's UFO researchers and investigators, and had personally investigated over 100 cases in Bolivia, Canada, China, Ecuador, Japan, Mexico, the Netherlands, Peru, Puerto Rico, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, and the United States. He had walked the sites, handled the evidence, and looked the people in the eye. Occasionally, he had been warned by governments not to pry. When I first encountered the phenomenon in the Air Force, Stevens said, I thought it was very interesting to know and I wanted to find out more about it. But then, I found out that the people I was passing information to were denying that it ever existed. And I was running into trouble trying to tell my stories to somebody else. That piqued my curiosity because of all the energy used to suppress the information. Why were they covering it up? If there was nothing to it, why worry about it? Then, when I got to investigating my own cases and found that witnesses had turned pictures over to authorities and they never knew really who these authorities were, and nobody could ever find the pictures again, I began to worry. Where were they all going? Who the hell was doing this and how? The phenomenon itself seems to be interwoven in our society from its very beginning, and we don't even understand that. If you go back through the Old Testament with different A's, you'll find some 68 passages that describe UFOs. Elijah was taken up by a wheel of fire, and Moses was spoken to out of a burning bush. That's no more than a green fireball that hovers in front of the sofa in somebody's house and talks to him, which I've run into at least 20 times in my investigations. I think part of the reason I chase UFOs is that I find realities there that are not realities to most other people. And I wonder why. It's too widespread to be nothing but a mental aberration. There are 70,000 cases per year reported worldwide. That's far too much for accidental storytelling. It's too much for a bunch of liars to be creating their own stories for their own prestige or status or whatever they seek as individuals. If I hadn't spent 30 years doing this, I wouldn't believe it if you told me. But I have come to accept it because I have seen so many cases and talked to so many different people who are not in touch with each other, who are sane, rational people with no axe to grind, and these things have happened to them. Bilu Zinstag and Wendell Stevens had never met, though they frequently had exchanged photographs and information on UFO cases. During his 30 years of collecting and investigating, Stevens had acquired a reputation for having a knowledgeable eye when it came to analyzing photographs. Zinstag knew of that reputation, and in the summer of 1976, she had written to Stevens, telling him briefly about the Mir case and mentioning the photographs taken by this one-armed, unemployed security guard. Prior to her letter, Stevens had heard nothing of the Mir case, but he knew Zinstag by reputation as well as through correspondence, and he doubted her fascination with the case was unfounded. Though she was vague about their content, Zinstag had 12 photographs she wanted Stevens to see, and instead of sending them by mail as she had often done in the past, she wanted to bring them herself from Switzerland to Stevens' home in Tucson, Timothy Good, to meet with some of the more prominent figures in American ufology, and to conduct research on George Adamski. On the prearranged day, she called Stevens from the Greyhound bus station in Tucson, and Stevens picked them up, got them checked into a motel, then drove them out to his house. They first wanted to see Stevens' UFO library, which took up an entire wall of the living room, and another wall in his small study. In addition to the 700 volumes on UFOs collected from all over the world, 30 blue binders containing Stevens' collection of nearly 3,000 UFO photographs stood side by side in three tight rows. Briefly, they discussed various cases, but Zinstag cut short the small talk when she pulled a folder from her satchel. As Timothy Good remembered, Lou brought a sort of dossier on Mir. Inside the folder lay a large envelope, which she opened carefully, then slid out a small stack of 5x7 photos. As she began laying out each photograph neatly on Stevens' dining room table, Stevens took one look and whispered, "I have nothing in my collection that even comes near the quality of these prints." When Stevens examined a UFO photograph, he looked first for relative focus, then for distance graying. "Distance attenuation is what I call it," he explained. "The further away an object is, the more moisture, smoke, and dust there will be in the atmosphere between it and the lens. Then, I would look for evidence of re-photographing. If it's got a fingerprint or specks on it, I turn it at an angle in the light. If what I'm looking at is not on the surface, then it's printed in the photograph, and that means that something preceded this picture. Also, The distance light travels has some relationship to the color that arrives at the lens. The closer the object is, the more red it appears, the further it is, the more blue. Another thing to look at is light scatter, because the curved surface on a larger object scatters light differently than the sharply curved surface on a nearer object. A model can be perfectly realistic, but it will cast light differently. Stevens examined each print carefully, holding it up to the light and tilting it. In 30 years of collecting and analyzing photographs of UFOs, Mir's photos were the most spectacular he had ever seen. Rarely was a UFO photograph more than a single accidental shot taken with poor equipment by an amateur who had no time to make adjustments for proper lighting, speed, and focus. Extremely rare was the photo taken in daylight, or with the UFO below the horizon, or with multiple craft in the same picture. And no one had ever taken a continuing series of photographs of the same craft. In the Mir photos, shiny silver disks, glinting from the sun, hovered in a blue sky above nearby hills and trees. A distinct red band encircled the upper convex rise on many of the sleekly contoured disks. Others were adorned with equally spaced knobs around the perimeter and a rococo dome on top. In all, Mir had photographs of six variations of spacecraft, each taken in daylight, some below the horizon, and some with two, three, even four spacecraft in the same picture. And each of the photos was the sharpest and clearest Stevens had ever seen. Timothy Good later remembered Stevens' reaction. He became absolutely in the seventh heaven when Lou showed him the photographs. He was thrilled. Absolutely. Words to the effect, best pictures I've seen. See, when Zinstag and Good had called from the bus station late that morning, Stevens had been entertaining friends down from Phoenix, Lee and Bush Elders. Lee Elders had been a close friend of Stevens for 5 years and was aware of Stevens' reputation as a UFO investigator. He and Britt were mildly interested themselves, having been educated in the phenomenon by Stevens. No one could go to Stevens' house and see the fat three-ring binders filled with pictures of flying saucers and not have his curiosity piqued. That afternoon, though, the mere photos that Lou Zinstag spread across the dining table amazed the Elders as much as Stevens. "Photographs of UFOs," said Britt, "are usually fuzzy little balls in the sky that have no definition. And they are so far away and so much out of focus, they could be just about anything." She laughed. "Sure, somebody has taken a little tiny miniature setting, put it together, and filmed it. That's what that is. Actually, Lee used to laugh at my UFO hobby," recalled Stevens. When he saw the photographs, his position was, "Ah, they're fakes. Anybody could look at those and tell their faces. They looked pretty good to me, but I had run across a lot of good pictures that were fakes, so I kind of half agreed. But I thought, man, these are the best fakes I've ever seen. How did he do it?" For the rest of the afternoon and into the evening, Stevens studied the photographs and listened to Zinstag recount her experiences with Mir. She told him about Mir's living conditions in the Hill House, his wife and children, and the many people who came to see him. She explained her relationship with Mir and how she had acquired the photos. The man was poor, she said, had only one arm, and seemed sincere. How many pictures had he taken of the craft? Stevens wanted to know. "Oh," replied Zinstag, "quite a few more." As he listened, Stevens perceived that Zinstag was trying to relay a sense of the man and his experiences without telling the whole story, as though she were protecting Stevens from some sort of sensory overload. The pictures spoke for themselves, but it seemed that much of the story, perhaps most of it, remained untold. This perception intrigued Stevens. The following morning, Zinstag and Good left for Los Angeles. For the next year, Stevens corresponded with Zinstag until he made contact with Mir himself and began a correspondence with him. Slowly, he realized that Mir had had more than a few contacts, that details of these contacts had been recorded, that perhaps many more, even hundreds of photographs existed, and that Mir may not have been the only one to have seen and experienced strange things in the forests surrounding Hinnell and now in the hills outside Schmidruti. In October 1977, A little over a year after Luzinstag and Timothy Good had come to Tucson, Stevens decided the case was worth an on-site investigation, and he made arrangements to fly to Switzerland to meet Billy Meier. "I'm just going to go over real quick and take a look," he told the elders. He hoped to get prints of some of the Meier photographs for his collection, and mainly to look the man in the eye to see if he's telling the truth. The elders laughed. "Tell us what happens when you get there," they said. D. Stevens flew to London, then took the train to Wiesbaden, Germany, where he delivered a UFO lecture. The next day, he took another train to Zurich, where he rented a car and began his drive to the Meier farm, as picturesque a drive as one could imagine. In October, the green countryside lay dotted with the bright reds and yellows of turning leaves, and many tree trunks supported burlap sacks filled with fresh-picked apples and pears. On nearly every hillside roamed light gray dairy cows with the glock or the trig dangling from their necks, tinkling as they grazed. Already the farmers had stacked winter wood head high, the split logs forming a face as smooth as a puzzle. The Meier farm stood not so picturesque. Meier and his family had been living at the farm now for only 6 months. Mud still lay everywhere, and Stevens saw outbuildings standing askew, their roofs sagging. The main house, which shared a common wall with the barn, had no upstairs, only open rafters, and the roof leaked. The only bathroom facilities sat behind the house, a lean-to built over a pit. In the kitchen, a pressure pump now brought in cold water from a holding tank, and Meier had wired the kitchen and the main room of the house with electricity for only two bare light bulbs. Most of the floors were still of dirt. When Stevens arrived at the farm, he saw two cars with people waiting to see Meier, one from Munich, one from Berlin. A few young Europeans, hitchhiking, or on bicycles or motorcycles, had pitched tents on the driest piece of ground they could find and lived there for a few days, working in the field or garden during the day, and talking to Meier in the evenings. Invited by the Meiers to stay at the farm if he liked, Stevens himself slept in a bedroll in the rafters above what used to be the barn. He felt that any case worth investigating deserved time, and it appeared that the Meier case deserved more than most. He wanted to get as close as he could. A year earlier in Tucson, Zinstag had told Stevens only that Meier had had more than one contact and that he had taken at least a dozen other photographs than the ones she had brought with her. In his first day at the farm, after meeting Meier and talking with a few other people, Stevens confirmed his earlier suspicion that Zinstag had held back some of what she knew about the case to avoid overwhelming him at the outset. Much to his surprise, Stevens found that Meier not only spoke passable English, but had a colorful way of expressing himself. When the two men met, Meier even offered him a challenge. He said he hoped the colonel would ask questions not asked by everyone else. He had so many different faces coming and going, said Stevens, and he had answered the same questions so many times for so many different people, he got sick of it. He didn't want to talk about it at all to outsiders because he'd explained to somebody else yesterday and somebody else the day before, and another one the day before, and another one the day before, and he didn't care. If you didn't ask the right questions, you didn't get the answers. During his 4 days in Switzerland, Stevens accompanied Meier on several long walks into the forest behind the farm, and when the weather turned bad he sat with Meier in the kitchen for hours poring over photo albums and talking. When Stevens asked about recent pictures of the beam ships, Meier gave him 130 photographic prints, charging him only for the cost of printing. Through an interpreter, Stevens also interviewed Popeye, the children, and half a dozen other witnesses, including Jacobus, Hans Schutzbach, and Herbert's friend Harold Brock, who was visiting with his sister. Each had his or her own stories to tell, and each was so convinced the contacts were taking place that when Stevens asked if they believed them, the common answer was, "I don't believe. I know." With the weather socked in, cold and damp, and visibility at the sites poor, the Gasthaus am Friedhof in Schmidruti provided Stevens with a quiet place to get away from the farm and sit in a warm parlor heated by a large wood stove. One gray morning, He retired to a table by the French windows that overlooked the road spiraling through the village, and began to read the background on the contacts. Mia's alleged experiences appeared to be far more complicated than a simple meeting 3 years earlier. Stevens thumbed through the voluminous pages of contact notes, beginning with Mia's account of his first contact with Sam Jays, a Tuesday afternoon, January 28, 1975, in a field not far from Hinwil. According to the notes, the January had been unseasonably warm in eastern Switzerland, and the winter had been unusually dry. Little snow clung to the lower elevations. Mia wrote that in the early afternoon he had been at his house in Hinwil when the twinkle of a thought had entered his consciousness, and then words and symbols has formed a message, one he had been expecting but not quite so soon. He was to leave his house and bring with him a device for taking pictures. Responding to the message, Mia had departed on his moped, taking with him an old Olympus 35mm camera with a broken viewfinder and a focus that jammed just short of infinity. He used this camera because the film advanced with a simple thumb wheel he found easy to operate with his one hand. On his motorbike, he had ridden aimlessly through the village, turning when the glimmer of a command directed him to. After an hour, he found himself far from the village, on a remote road bordering a nature conservancy where he received a final command to stop his motorbike and wait. After several minutes, a sudden stillness descended upon the meadow, and then a large disc-shaped object shot soundlessly through light clouds, slowed in a wide graceful arc, and crossed the meadow 400 or 500 feet from where Mia stood aiming his camera. But the moment he snapped a picture, the disc had vanished. When the disc reappeared again, it hovered above a truck parked at the edge of the meadow, only 100 feet from where Mia stood. He watched the disc suspended quietly no more than 300 feet off the ground. Mia estimated the disc to be about 21 feet in diameter, with reddish rectangles, like windows, encircling its upper mound. Beneath the craft, the hull, exceedingly old in appearance, seemed to undulate as if little waves ran continuously through the lower side of the ship. The waves radiated downward, creating an aura around the truck. Mia took a second picture, and again the spacecraft abruptly broke its hovering pattern, rushed toward the east, and disappeared into the clouds. Climbing onto his moped, Mia had then headed out across the meadow in the direction he had last seen the disc. Only moments passed before he felt a stillness suddenly descend upon the meadow. Then, the disc came streaking through the clouds again, faster than any jet Mia had ever seen. It dropped speed quickly, banked slowly over the forest, and began its descent toward the clearing. Mia took two more pictures as the craft, without a sound, dropped lower and lower, and then landed. In the warm parlor of the Frith, Stevens put down the notes and sipped his hot tea. The encounter Mia was about to describe in the notes, he now knew, was only the culmination of a series of phenomena in Mia's life that Mia claimed had been set in motion 35 years ago. Before he read further, Stevens wanted to question Mia about the earlier experiences. Back in the kitchen at the farmhouse, Mia did not hesitate to tell Stevens the long story of his involvement with the Pleiadians, a story that began in his childhood. He said his first sighting of an alien spacecraft occurred one morning when he was only 5.5 years old. This was in 1942 together with my father, said Mia. He was behind the house under a walnut tree, it was summertime. When I saw the ship flying, it didn't necessarily seem strange to me. It did look strange in our world, but somehow I had the feeling that it was something familiar. It fell down from the sky, to the tower of the church, and then it came to us and left westward. It was very, very fast. Altogether, I watched it fall for maybe 1.5 minutes, and then when it left westward, there were seconds only. The object had reminded Mia of a huge discus, shooting overhead only 600 feet off the ground, completely soundless, and disappearing over the horizon. He asked his father, "Daddy, what's happened here?" But his father only replied, "It's a secret weapon of Adolf Hitler." "I was thinking that can't be true," said Mia, "that's something else." I don't know if my father realized what he saw because he didn't bother with it anymore. I started to watch the sky day and night. Mia told Stevens that 2 months had passed before he again saw the silvery flying disc, this time descending slowly toward the field where he was playing alone. But as the disc neared the grassy surface, suddenly, without a sound, it had vanished.